So we should probably jump right into follow-up. Wait. There is no follow-up.
Good job. We're done. Woohoo!
Fastest follow-up ever.
Why is that again?
I do have some long-range follow-up because last time we recorded, I had not hosted my kibbutz yet, which I think I'm saying that right now.
Yeah, thanks to the episode that's went live today as we're recording it.
Yes. So that was kind of fortuitous for me because my kibbutz got pushed back a couple of weeks, and then we got to record the Author's Corner episode that dropped today as we record this with Nir Eyal, and there's a big section in there where I asked him about tips for the kibbutz, and he shared a whole bunch of really cool stuff. The interview turned out great. It probably was not what you had in mind when you put together Author's Corner.
No. This is very, very different than what I intended.
So I hope you're okay with that, but I thought it was a great conversation. Nir's a great guy.
Yeah, for sure.
And it was a lot of fun. So go check that out. It's a bonus episode, and it's available in your podcast feed right now, even as we record this. But I did want to follow up with the actual kibbutz because that was a big action item for me following the, actually it might have been the first Indistractable, and then we read The Art of Gathering because I wanted to do this, and then it got pushed back, so we haven't been able to really talk about that yet. And like I said, we hosted it. Regardless of the circumstances, we made it work, which again, circumstances kind of worked against us for this. There are two other couples from our church that we invited over in between services on Sunday because we are there in the morning. We're also there in the evening. So the afternoons, we have a few hours at home, not a ton of time. And it's just a personal decision that we've made that this is what we're going to do with our Sundays. We're going to take our rest a different day. And so that's our approach. And we got this little window in the middle. And we're like, how can we make the most of this? Because you're not going to just go like, by the time you would go chill out and unwind, you're getting ready to go back to church. So we identified that couple hour block as like a great spot for specifically other families who are kind of in the same situation as we are. So both of these other couples that we invited to our kibbutz, they're kind of in that spot too. Like, well, what do we do during the afternoon? So we're like, come over to our house. We'll get some food and we'll just hang out. And that's kind of all the framing I did for it. I did share a little bit about how like we want to make this a regular thing prior to having them over because we want to build these relationships. Basically, we care about you guys and we want to build this intentionally over time. We know that this is not just going to be a happy accident sort of a thing. So you guys down to give this a shot? And they said, yeah. So they came over, and that Sunday that they came over, it turned out that our pastor asked all three of us, so myself and then the two other males from the couples, they also typically will speak different parts of the services, but we didn't have anything on the agenda at the time. And then after the AM service, all three of us got a message from our pastor saying, hey, can you guys preach tonight? Each take a turn. We're like, okay, because you can't really... can't really say no to that. But at the same time, we're like, could you pick a different Sunday?
right. Please move this.
We've been trying to do this for like a month, and we really just were committed to making it work. So we're like, well, we've all got a prep now, but let's just do it anyways. And you know, if we got to bounce early, no hard feelings, whatever. So had people over, had the meal. There were at our house, I think 11 kids between the three families, and we told them all, go in the basement and don't come up unless you're bleeding, per Nir's suggestion, which kind of worked, kind of didn't. I think that'll take some more coaching, but that's okay. We kind of knew that.
Sure.
Also, the older kids kind of wanted to linger upstairs. Like they kind of sensed that we were going to do something and they wanted to see what it was. And we're just like, no, go away. And so eventually, you know, they went downstairs and we had about an hour, maybe an hour and a half of just like intentional conversation, which my wife and I kind of kicked off. And this was the part I was super nervous about because I wanted to kind of set the tone for this sort of thing based on what we had learned through The Art of Gathering. And share like an implementation intention, as Nir had put it in that interview, but also didn't want to just like scare everybody away. So we kind of shared like, this is kind of what we've been thinking through lately, and this is what we've been struggling with, and this is kind of what we've learned. And we really want to set this course for our family, for our relationships. Like, we see you guys as being an integral part of our future. We love you guys. We want to make sure that our relationship is not just one where we show up at church together and we serve or we work together, but we value you guys, and we want to do this on a regular basis to build those relationships. And everybody was much more into it than I kind of anticipated that they would be. It was received really, really well, basically. I was a little concerned going into it that it would kind of drift off into just like small talk after we shared our piece, and then we kind of asked specific questions to kind of draw from other people like what they thought of different situations that we knew they were kind of in the same situation as we were. So I was kind of shocked, honestly, about how quickly we were able to get past the superficial stuff and enter into like the deep, meaningful conversations. Nir shared in that interview how there was one point where they were talking with this guy and they were just getting to that point when the kids came up and they ruined it. You know, so I kind of thought, based off of that brief description, that this is going to be the kind of thing that you've really got to dig, and you really got to set the atmosphere for this. And maybe it'll take like a half an hour or an hour to even get there. But maybe it's just the limited expectations that I had for this first one. I was really impressed and happy with where we were able to get to in just an hour, hour and a half. And then, you know, we had to leave. We had to go prep for service, which was fine. But it went really well is the too long didn't read version here. And we intend to keep doing this once a month. So I view this as a huge success.
Good work, sir. It sounds like it was at least, you know, a good beginnings to something that's more long term. Is that fair?
Yes. I think that it is, even taking out the framing of, you know, this is the beginning of a long term thing. If this was just a single event, I think it was successful.
Sure.
And not just because I tend to think worst case scenario and, oh my gosh, this is going to be a disaster, and it wasn't a disaster. Like, this is kind of, I kind of had a picture in my head of where I wanted it to get to eventually. And I feel like we got there even in the first one.
Nice.
So there's probably a lot more room for growth with this. There's probably many, many more levels to get to that I don't really see yet. But even with the progress that we've made so far, I think that this is awesome.
Sure. Sure. Now, what is it that you know, you've been through this once? What is the thing or things that you feel you need to change for the next round, if that's something you can share?
Yeah, well, I think the biggest thing that we need to change is we need to set the parameters and have people respect them a little bit more strongly regarding the kids do their thing, we do our thing, which I think is maybe a little bit easier now because we were able to share based on how we directed the thing. Like, we didn't want to force it and be like, okay, now everybody do this.
Sure.
You know, it's more like we had to invite people to go in a certain way and then see how they responded. It felt really, maybe stressful is the right word for me, because I'm like, I know where I want this to go, but I don't know if anybody else wants to go there with me.
Sure.
So let's see, you know, but now we've kind of established that this everybody likes. And this is kind of the mission for these things going forward. Everybody says they're on board with it. So now that the expectations are kind of set, I think we can move through the beginning phases of this maybe a little bit more quickly. We may still have to figure out something to keep kids entertained, organized activities. I don't know. But the way our house is set up, we've got a big open basement, which is the size of the whole upstairs of our house. It's the way we bought this house basically because that was all open and we were going to be able to finish that off however we wanted to.
Right.
My boys have a bedroom down there. My office is down there, but otherwise it's all open. We got a ping pong table down there and it's basically doubles the square footage of our house. So it's not like we're shoving them all in a tiny room and be like, here, be quiet.
Yeah.
They got plenty of room to go do stuff. I think when it gets nicer outside, they'll be able to go outside and do stuff. I'm really not too worried about that, but that's probably the area where there's room for improvement.
So it's with the kids, like the potential for distraction through kids. Have you ever thought about, maybe this is a bad idea, but hiring a babysitter of sorts just to be with them and take care of the bloody noses and such? Because I've seen that happen before where you hire one or two teenagers to watch the kids while two or three couples are upstairs doing their thing.
Yeah, well, shortly there will be three teenagers in this group.
Oh, sure. So, yeah, yeah.
So they're all younger. So to be honest, though, that was not an idea that had entered my head. And I think that makes sense. Rachel's done that before when she's needed to focus on something at work or at home for a work project. And I'm out of town or whatever, she'll hire somebody to come watch the kids while she's at home. She just retreats to my office, focuses on what she needs to do. So that's not a bad idea. But also, I think this is kind of just a season that we're into. Like, I'm really not worried about this long term. It's gonna be fine. But
yeah. Well, cool. I'm glad it went well. I hope it continues.
Thank you. Me too. All right. That's all we got for follow up. So let's talk about today's book.
Woo!
Today's book is It Doesn't Have to Be Crazy at Work by Jason Fried and David Hanemeyer Hansen, which I will hereby to refer to as the Basecamp guys. It's really a book about how they do things at Basecamp. And it's written like a lot of the other books that they've written, like Rework and Remote, kind of as a series of blog posts. I don't follow the 37 Signals blog, to be honest, so I can't tell you which of these were published as blog posts and which ones were just collected into the book itself, but it does feel like a collection of blog posts that are sorted into seven different sections. First, curb your attention, defend your time, feed your culture, dissect your process, mind your business, and then last. So I'm thinking for today, we can kind of break this down piece by piece.
Sure. Sure. And just to point that out, first is the first section and last is the last section. Like, it sounds a little funny when you say it. First, curb your attention. No, first is the first, curb your attention is the second.
Yeah, true.
But I should also say that, like, I think you have a special vested interest in this because I know, like, your work cycles follow a lot of the mentality that comes from the Basecamp team. Mine is slowly morphing its way into that. I've been slowly putting together some form of like a 6 or 7 week cycle with my work at the church as well. So like, this is something that I'm seeing, like, you and I have a vested interest in this, but it's also something that a lot of people in the tech industry have followed the Basecamp company and how they do things. And I think that's because, like, they're such a small team with regards to the size of audience that they serve, like the size of the customer base that they serve. So it's kind of an anomaly, the Basecamp company. And I think that's really cool. So it's kind of neat to see how they are working and how they put together, you know, their working patterns. And I'm with you. I don't know how much of this is blog posts versus originals. I do follow the 37 Signals blog, but I can't say that this is one that as I was reading these, like, yes, that one was a blog post. I remember reading, I didn't have any of that. And this is the second time I've gone through this book. So I can't say that these are all blog posts, but it's definitely that style. Like, it feels like a bunch of posts put together, which I'm not saying is bad. It is an interesting book. It's a very quick read, I found, because of that. So
interesting. I did not know that this was your second time through the book. It's my second time also. I covered it previously as a gap book, but
yep, I did the same.
Awesome. What was your general impression reading through it the second time compared to the first time?
That I don't do things well. I have a lot of room for improvement. that's a lot of it. There are a lot of correlations with what I do now that would lend itself to adopting a lot of what they do. in the IT world where it's difficult for me to translate it this time. Because when I read it the first time, I was, you know, neck deep in running a web development company and working with clients and had a lot of the same, you know, processes that I needed to work through that the Basecamp team does. Right now, I don't as much. I'm a one-man band when it comes to technology and my team at the church. Now, granted, I'm working with a lot of other people, you know, to put on events and make sure equipment is up and down. Like, I have to work with them, but that's on a day-to-day basis. There are no real big, long-term, six-week-long projects. Most of my projects are 1 to 2 weeks, if that. Sometimes they're just, this is a one-day project and it's done. I have a lot of those. So I'm not real sure how a lot of this translates to that. That's the part that I'm working through, and that was the part that struck me this time around. I didn't know this was your second time going through it.
Yes. The first time that I read this, I was still at AE. And the second time, obviously my work situation is a little bit different now. And like you mentioned, a lot of the Blanc Media stuff is based off of kind of a mashup of what Sean got when he was at the Basecamp workshop at their office in Chicago, where they kind of talked about how they work. And also, I know a big influence with the way that we do the work cycles also was Sean McCabe with the, he does the 7th week sabbaticals. And actually, as we record this, he's in the 7th year since he started that process. So he has taken the entire year off, and he's kind of chronicling his journeys. He's going around the country, meeting people, hosting meetups, and it's interesting. David and I interviewed him a while back on the Focus podcast about this because he was kind of still apprehensive about the idea of taking the entire year off, but he's doing it to his credit. And I've been following his Instagram stories, and it's kind of cool. He and Lacey, his wife, they sold their house and they're traveling. And I can't wait to see when he's done with this, kind of what the benefit has been from that. But on a smaller scale, I've seen a lot of benefit myself from every 8th week, the Blanc Media team taking the entire week off. Kind of a forced vacation, if you will. The first time I did it, it felt really weird. It felt like, I don't want to take a break. I've got this project that I'm working on. I want to keep going. Now it's to the point where it really, like, it's something that I look forward to. And we talked about Scrum and the whole idea behind Scrum and sprints being that, like, you sprint for a short period of time and then you can take a step back and reevaluate. Well, I feel like the sabbaticals really create the space for you to take that step back and really evaluate. If you just implement Scrum to the letter, you never create that space to really think objectively about what actually happened, then it's limited in its effectiveness, in my opinion. So the first time that I read this, there were things in here that I read and I was like, well, that sounds kind of cool, but that'll never happen. And since I read it the first time, some of those things have happened. So it's a little bit different for me going through it the second time. There are still a couple things in here where I was like, oh, we should maybe change the way that we do this and incorporate an aspect of that. But it wasn't the same as when I went through it the first time. It's like, it kind of felt like a very foreign, different culture, different idea. Kind of, you know, you hear people talk about something and you can't wrap your head around it, and it almost seems like too good to be true sort of a deal. It felt a lot more attainable, a lot more real when I went through it the second time. Obviously, there's still little things, room for improvement, stuff like that. And I'm not trying to paint a picture of like work was awful at AE either, but it's just a totally different system from like Scrum and story points and tracking everything to, it doesn't have to be crazy at work. It's just kind of like, we trust you, go do good work, show us what you did.
Right.
That's very oversimplified, but that's kind of the idea.
Yeah. And it's one that I think a lot of people can resonate with, because we are like the traditional worker is, I don't want to say micromanaged, but every little detail is watched. at least whenever I was in corporate and even whenever I was working for clients, like they wanted to know where every 30-minute block went, or sometimes every 15-minute block. They wanted to know all of that and wanted to know how productive you were with that time, which just kind of drives you up a wall over time. And it feeds this whole monster of email and chat systems and such. Like it feeds all of that, the Slack systems. It's too much. And I think going through this a couple times, I'll say this. This is one of the few books that I find myself wanting to go back to and reread occasionally. Going through this a second time, it reiterated that for me, that I really should like read this every 6 months or something, just to, you know, refocus my brain on things. So spoiler alert, I'll recommend this one.
All right. Well, let's jump in here with the first section, literally first. And just real briefly, the basic idea here at the very beginning that I want to call out is that your company is a product, and Jason and David say that it should be your best product. And the goal is to create a calm company. It's basically a rallying cry. They say, yes, it's possible. And it kind of sets up the rest of the book where they're going to detail their process. But I also think it's worth explaining here, because I would argue, even if you don't run a company, there's still a lot you can get out of this book. And you may find yourself in a position where there's not a whole lot you can do to implement some of the stuff that you learn in here, but there will be little things that you can do here and there. And that's the value in a lot of this stuff. There's a lot of like little nuggets as you go through this book. It's not a system. It's not, you know, a 5-point whatever plan to create a calm company. It's just all of the little things that they do and brief descriptions of why. And you could probably dive in real deep into some of this stuff. I'm sure there are books written about individual things that they spend like 2 paragraphs talking about. But that makes it a lot more approachable for the average person too. You don't need to be a CEO and you don't need to have an MBA in order to get something from this book.
For sure. Yeah. I think there's a lot of, at least in this very beginning part, it's helpful because they give you the background of Basecamp and where they've come from, what it is they do. So it's important, I think, to have that before you go through the rest of this, because it does set up the context for what we're talking about. I don't know that at this point there's many people who don't know about Basecamp or have heard the name of the product and company. Like, people know Basecamp at this point. So if you don't know them, go to basecamp.com. You'll figure it out real quick.
Yep. And Basecamp as a product is interesting. They share a couple things specifically towards the later chapters that are probably worth unpacking, but there's 7 different sections in here, so I don't think I have anything else to say about this first section. Maybe we should move on to the second one.
I'm good.
Okay, so the second section is Curb Your Ambition, and there's one thing specifically I wanted to talk about from this section, not just because it validates kind of a belief that I've I've established, yep, even more strongly the last couple of books that we've went through, but it also kind of refreshed in my mind that maybe this is the first place I kind of heard this. But they have this thing, they call it an anti-goal mindset, where they are against goals. The anti-goal mindset, they talk about, it's disingenuous to pretend that you care about a number that you just made up, and they aren't willing to make the cultural compromises that it takes to achieve those goals a lot of times. They talk about how chasing goals often causes people to compromise their morals in order to get there. I found that myself. I mean, not even encouraged by the company culture, just intrinsic pressure on myself to make sure that whatever we're going to be doing is awesome. I tend to want to keep working past 5 p.m. I am thinking about it on the weekends, and I got to like force myself to disconnect on a Saturday. And like, no, you're not going to work on those videos for the product that's going to be launched in a couple of weeks. Like, it'll be fine. Just chill, dude.
Sure.
And I think that the setting goals, especially in a work context, definitely does kind of implicitly encourage people to cut those corners and do what they can to make sure that the end product is awesome and that the company is successful. So the easy, humane way to deal with that from a management perspective is just to get rid of the goals in the first place.
Yeah, I've done a lot of different goal setting exercises in the past. And whenever I've gone through, so the last two times I've gone through this one now, these two times I've gone through this, I find myself like, no, I don't want to do goals. Like, we've done 12-week year. We've done, how many different things have we done where, like, set your goals and they'll achieve themselves, basically. Like, that seems to be the sentiment, which is so far from the truth. I find that, for me, I just don't want to do it. Like, I'm only recently starting to put together, like, what a long-term vision would look like and, like, where I want things to go. But at the same time, like, any time I've tried to break that down to, like, three-month periods or even, like, the whole 12-week period, it just doesn't work out. Like, I end up changing them frequently, about every month to 6 weeks. Funny that time frame adds up. But it's just something I find doesn't work. Like, how many people talk about goal setting and how important that is? You know, we're not far off of the new year right now, and I'm sure there are a lot of goals that people set at January 1 and they've not touched them or they've changed them six times already. Like, it's, I feel like it's more headache than it's worth.
Yeah.
It just is.
I am a little bit conflicted by this because I think that goal setting does have some value in giving you a direction to go. But once you set the goal in the 12-week year specifically, I like that framework. My personal retreat course is built off of that framework. And I do think that it works, but not if you focus on the goal. You have to follow the other pieces of it and break it down into the habits that you're going to do consistently. And then you just got to focus on the habits, let the score take care of itself. It's hard to disconnect, though, from that end result. My tendency is to focus on the end result and to continually pick at it and try to move the needle as it pertains to the accomplishment of that goal. And I have to fight against that in myself. But I also think that one of the things I've learned from the 12-week year format specifically is that I don't like incorporating work stuff into my 12-week year planning anymore.
Sure.
I keep it separate. And I keep actually everything at work separate. And I think a big part of that is because we use Basecamp. Basecamp is not one of those products that has like a bunch of incredible technical features. There's nothing in there, I think, that is revolutionary from a technical perspective. It's just built on this ethos that you shouldn't be able to be interrupted when you're doing what you should be doing. And we'll talk about like work chat and stuff like that as we go through this book. But it gives you kind of like enough to direct your work and then nothing else. And the first thing that people say when they look at Basecamp, I think, is like, well, it's not going to do X for me. I'm like, yeah, that's the point. The intentional constraints.
Like, it's, yeah, you're right. It's not going to do that. Woohoo! Like,
yeah.
That's
and,
a good thing.
But that's scary for some people who have worked a certain way around the idea of goals. Like, if you're coming from Scrum and you look at Basecamp, you're like, there's no way we can use that. But as we talked about, there's a whole nother way of working, which is not based off of story points and backlog grooming. It's just, this is the thing we want to build, and now let's show up and do an honest day's work every day, but confine it to human timeframes where it's sustainable. You know, they have on the cover all of the things with a big red X on them, like 80-hour weeks, packed schedules, super busy, endless meetings, overflowing inbox, unrealistic deadlines, can't sleep, Sunday afternoon emails, no time to think, stuck at the office, all-nighters, chats blowing up. I mean, we probably all been subject to those things in some way, shape, or form previously. And I can think of specific examples for just about all of them.
Yeah.
Not that I want to really even talk about those things here, but it's when you buy into the philosophy then you can say, okay, I'll try to make this work. But when you just look at the product, it's easy to say, no, that won't do it for me.
I want to point out one thing, because there's a perceived disconnect here with goal setting, and you know, a lot of people talk about the 6-week cycles that Basecamp works on, because it can seem like they're working off of goals whenever you're doing that. But it's important to know that whenever Basecamp sets up their intention for those 6-week periods, they don't have like set like numbers that they're trying to hit. Like they have guideposts that they set up that they're trying to stay within as far as achieving the work that they're setting out to achieve. It's not necessarily a marker in the sand that they're trying to cross by a certain date. It's a very different setup. So they have those guideposts, and they're given the creative liberty to work their way towards something at the other end that keep, but they're staying within those guideposts as they go.
Yes.
So they don't call those goals, and I don't think I would call them goals, because it's not really the line in the sand. It's not something you're trying to achieve per se, but it's a task to accomplish, if you can catch the subtle difference there.
Yeah, because their goal is not to change the world, it's to do good work. They even say that exact phrase in this section.
Right.
And they say that one of the things that I highlighted in my MindNode file, the mind map for this book, is that you can dare to be completely ordinary every now and then. And that's the thing with goals, I think, is everybody wants to achieve something extraordinary. And the fact of just putting in an ordinary effort, that's like a mark of shame almost. It's like, well, what do you mean? Don't you want to be excellent? Well, yeah, I want to be excellent, but I also want to operate within these boundaries. And Basecamp is able to say these boundaries exist, so we're not going to move these, as opposed to most company cultures. When you have a stated goal, the implicit pressure, even if it's not explicitly stated, is you really should be thinking about this goal and moving towards this goal with every waking moment. They would even say, put in your 40 hours and go home, but they want you so bought into the vision for the goal that it's impossible, if you were to do it the way they want you to, that it's impossible to disconnect from it when you do leave the office. And for knowledge workers who work remotely like I do, my office is my home, so I have to work even harder at this. And I think without a company telling you that they don't want you doing it that way, that you will probably find yourself falling into that.
For sure. Yeah, I just don't do goals.
At least company goals.
Yeah.
But that also kind of gets into the basis for their whole company. You know, they talk later on about how they don't want to be the product for the Fortune 500. They want to be the product for the Fortune 5 million. They want to be something that anybody can use, which that is a little bit different than most people's approach to business too. But
right.
Let's get into the next section here. Number 3 is defend your time. A couple things I wanted to talk about here. The first one is something that I actually disagree with in this book, and not really if you dig into it deeper, but the way it's phrased, I do. They make a statement that productivity is for machines, not for people. And they use the terminology that effectiveness and productivity are kind of opposites. And I get where they're coming from. And if I had Jason Fried's experience, I maybe would describe it the same way. But I don't. And I don't view productivity as simply the number of widgets that get cranked out in a set period of time. If that is how you define productivity, then yes, productivity and effectiveness are opposites. But I think productivity is more about intentionality and doing what you said you were going to do, not focusing on the outcome or the goal as whether you achieved it or not, but did you do what you set out to do? And from that perspective, productivity and effectiveness are very much the same thing. Now, they do say that people tend to fill every moment. And I get that. That's kind of what I was saying earlier. When you have a goal, you try to use every spare moment towards the achievement of that goal. And that isn't actually what you should be doing. Sometimes having nothing to do is actually extremely productive. And people tend to fill every moment, but that doesn't mean that you have to. And so I would say that I would fight back a little bit against the idea of productivity simply as what percent progress did you make towards a goal, and really kind of redefine it as you've got this intention and did you follow through with it?
I am slowly not caring what words we use anymore. I totally get your point, Mike, and I get a lot of the productivity world and community wants to redefine productivity to include effectiveness and intentionality. I get that. I just don't care anymore. I think, like, sure, my goal is to be, my goal is to be intentional and effective. And if we want to define productivity as those, I think that's fine. I think if you have a big company corporate background and that's all you know, and you just know big business, you're going to define productivity as the output versus the input. Like, that's just the way that you're going to view it. So
yeah,
I think the general population is going to view it the way that Jason Fried spelled it out here. So I'm not going to fault him for saying it that way. I can't say that I would reword it any different, because I think you have to use the normal everyday definitions of these words whenever you're putting them into print like this. Otherwise, it's just, someone's reading it and they're going to have one view, but that's not what you intended. And then they're going to take it wrong, and then it's going to have the wrong impact. So I have a tendency to, like, sure, I think I get your point, but I think I would disagree with you in that I don't think I would have said it differently. But I think we're splitting hairs when we start getting upset about what words are being used in different arenas. So at least whenever we're trying to define, like, am I being effective? Like, what should I be in these scenarios? I think when we're coming down to that point, it's just a matter of spelling out clearly what your intention is, not trying to say, I'm into productivity and here's what I mean by that. Like, that, I feel like that's sometimes misleading in trying to take a term and then redefine it to be what you want it to be. Is that fair?
Yeah, it is. It just makes me sad because we're not going to have any words left pretty soon. I mean,
it's
this is
true.
The same thing. As we're recording this, Eric Fisher, Beyond the To-Do List, has re-edited and republished a couple of interviews that he did with Merlin Mann back in the day. Merlin is the guy who invented Inbox Zero and then got so upset at the productivity world redefining it from what he meant for it that he just kind of completely left and does stuff that's kind of completely unrelated at this point. Maybe that's unfair.
Right.
I haven't attended any workshops that Merlin has done recently, but
sure,
the stuff that you see him doing is like the Roderick on the Line and Due by Friday and stuff like that, where it kind of feels like he's pushed back on that a lot, and with good reason, I think. And I feel like that's kind of the options that you're left with when you let people redefine the words. And not even redefine the words, but I would say you have to say something if you want to be able to accurately define the words. Like, another word that a lot of people have a very negative reaction to, rightfully so, is the word hustle, because they think of Gary Vee and work and sleeping 3 hours a night because you're so consumed with the work that you're doing. I wrote a whole book on how I actually think that that's crazy and attempt to redefine it a different way, but I'm not going to win that battle. I know that.
Sure.
But I still think it's worth calling out that, like, hey, maybe, you know, like the Princess Bride, Vicini's like, you keep using that word. I do not think it means what you think it means. So I don't know the right path forward for an educated dialogue about this type of stuff, but I do think personally that it is worth fighting for the term productivity and not defining it as simply corporate efficiency, which you're totally right. I don't have a corporate background. That has been made abundantly clear to me.
I'm not trying to rub it in your face. I'm not trying to.
I know. Not just you. But I understand that my perspective on this is going to be different than a lot of other people. But in my opinion, this is what it should mean. and it doesn't for a lot of people. That's okay. But this right here specifically, I think that he's right. You know, you don't want to just focus on efficiency and crank out widgets because that is for machines. But I think that productivity is a positive thing. It's being effective at what you set out to do. And sometimes that is measured in the form of output, but you almost don't have to be worried about that so much. That's not how you measure the effectiveness. You know, it kind of, I don't know. I'm thinking of like the four disciplines of execution and like the wildly important goals. I have a negative response to that idea as well. But productivity, still, when I think of that word, like it's exciting to me. It's motivating because it means that I have the ability to produce something that is worthwhile. And the key to doing that is in the intentional approach to what I'm going to be doing. And I feel like that should be exciting for anybody with a growth mindset, you know, to go back to Carol Dweck's book, because it means that your future isn't set in stone. You're not going to be cranking widgets for the rest of your life. You have the ability to set your course, and your future is not created yet, and you have the ability to produce it, but don't do it by working 80 hours a week.
Sure.
Or setting a giant goal.
And I want to be clear that like, I'm not saying you shouldn't argue for a better definition of a word. Like I think there is a lot of validity in that. I think there's a difference in that versus choosing which words you're using when you're writing a book like this.
Yeah.
Because I feel like you have to use the commonly accepted definitions in order to convey your idea. Otherwise, you're kind of splitting hairs. But the difference there is there are times when you read books and then they define a word a certain way and then use that word in that way throughout the book. I think that's fine too. He didn't define productivity in this sense, which means you have to assume he's using just the generally accepted version of that.
Yeah, true. Valid point. The next thing that we should talk about here is the presence prison, because this is another idea that's fascinating to me. This might take a while to talk about this.
All right.
So the presence prison refers to kind of the group chats, the status bubbles, and I have totally fallen into this myself, where you've got the green being that you're available. Yellow, I think, typically is like you're away. Red is do not disturb, or you're not online. And you find yourself looking at those status bubbles to see who you can ask when you have a question or a problem. And Basecamp deliberately does not have status indicators for the people who are a part of your team inside of Basecamp. And this, again, if you're used to working remotely, you might think like, well, that's a deal breaker. I can't work that way. But it requires a totally different approach, something that they intentionally have built into their culture of this eventual response. So you ask your question and someone else can deal with it when they have time, not as soon as they see it, and you use the presence indicators as an indication of who you can bother. You know, I don't know if you've seen that before, where you have the people in your organization or on your team and you just kind of go down the list and you look for the first green dot. And then you're like, oh, there's somebody I can ask this question to.
Right.
Because I need this answer right away. Well, Basecamp would say, no, you don't need that answer right away.
Right.
And I think this is maybe for some people a very radical idea, but having worked this way now for almost the last year, this is better. Let me tell you.
I know that whenever I was doing freelance client work, I got to the point where I was on tons of Slack teams, not channels, teams. And it was a thing where some of those clients would ask me, what time zone are you in? Like, they would ask me where I'm located. And what they were intending by that was, when will you be on Slack? When can I bother you on Slack? Was basically the question being asked. And at first I was it didn't even occur to me what they were trying to get at. I would tell them, and then I wouldn't necessarily be on Slack, but then I would get the email saying, hey, I thought you were going to be on Slack. Well, I suppose. So I'd hop on, and then they'd ask me their questions and such. And
I want to bother you.
Yeah, I mean, it was, you know, a thing that happened. But I then realized that they would take advantage of that and use it to get, like, free consultation for products. And I was not willing to give that out. So I got to the point, not long before I quit doing that, I got to the point, it's like, you know, I have a Slack account. You're welcome to add me. If you would like me to be available, that's fine. I simply add it to the billable hours.
There we go.
And, you know, they're not terribly interested in asking you tons of questions on Slack and making sure you're there when they're paying for you to be on it. Like, it's very, very different whenever they do that. And I say that, and yet I had one client that was willing to pay me to be on Slack for 3 hours a day for, I think, 2 weeks, I think, is what it worked out to. So I ended up getting paid to just have Slack open for them for 3 hours a day for 2 weeks. Like, that's just what they wanted. Like, okay, like, that's fine by me. Like, as long as I can have the clock running, I'm fine. And that's exactly what I did. But I was able to double bill some of those hours because they didn't use it, and I was working on somebody else's project at that time. So I understand the whole green dot obsession, because a lot of people want to be available, but you can't get anything done. Like, you just can't.
Yeah.
Like, especially in that type of role, whenever I was doing that, it was very easy for me to find, like, if I'm on that many teams and say I had 15 or 16 clients that were active at one time, which was not uncommon, I could spend the entire day just answering Slack messages. My entire day could do that and not get anything else done. And that is not what I needed to be doing. Now, if I was able to bill all of those at the same time, that would have been great. But that's not the way it works. So I don't like this whole chat culture that we've built. I feel like people, if they would realize that Slack themselves, the Slack company, tells their employees to turn it off whenever they go home.
Yeah.
Like,
exactly.
If people realize that, I don't think they would have the expectations of their employees like they do. All that to say, don't use Slack.
It's human nature. It's kind of the redefining of the inbox zero too. It's a battle that you're going to lose no matter how hard you're going to fight for it, because people gonna people, and the lizard brain is gonna take over. I do think that it's a little bit different, not in a freelance perspective, but as a employer-employee perspective. The employee, maybe you have expectations in your workplace that you are supposed to be online, especially if you work remote. I get it, where people want to know that you're at your computer and that you are doing work while you are working from home. But the Basecamp guys would say that you don't need that. In fact, on page 65, they say, how do you know if someone is working if you can't see them? Same answer as this question. How do you know if someone is working if you can't see them? You don't. The only way to know work is getting done is by looking at the actual work. That's the boss's job. If they can't do that job, they should find another one. So, and maybe this, you know, it's worth calling out here that this doesn't mean that you need to set the goals and measure the outcomes. But on the one hand, the better way to work is to leave people alone so that they do the work, and then you can see the work that they are able to produce as evidence that they are doing what they should be doing, trusting that everybody is grown up enough to manage themselves. And maybe there's a lot of workplaces where that's a not true assumption, that not everybody could manage themselves. And so they do need to have people who are looking over their shoulder all the time. Again, I am thankful for my corporate ignorance in this this regard. But I also think another piece, that there's some truth here where a lot of management thinks that they need to be able to see certain things, and maybe those certain things are not the things that we should be paying attention to. Another thing I'm thinking of would be like video in like remote meetings. And if I can see your eyeballs, I know that you're engaged. Well, not really. You don't know that. In fact, most people who are in the meeting are probably checking their email or doing other work, even if their webcam is on.
Right.
And the better approach would be let them do the work that they need to do, that they're trying to do in the middle of the meeting anyways, and just let them miss the meeting.
Right.
Which they talk about in this section too, the joy of missing out. JOMO, they say on page 70 that most people should miss out on most things most of the time. I think that's a great general rule.
There's a product that lets you turn on your webcam and it's on all day long. It's for remote teams, and then they can see who's at their desk or not. Do you know what I'm talking about? I'm trying to remember, is it Buffer that uses this or used to? I remember seeing this at one point, and the intent behind it was that companies could use this, and it created this wall of webcams for either your team or the entire company, and you could see who was working and who wasn't. You weren't talking to each other. It was just video only. And it was just a thing that you could see if someone was at their desk or not. And my thought was when I saw it is,
happening. My gosh. I had not heard of that, but it makes my skin crawl.
I know. It's like the
butts
green
in
dot
the seats.
On steroids. Totally. It's totally butts in the seats. It's exactly what it is.
We could get into a whole discussion here about the traditional school system and why we homeschool, but we won't.
Yeah, we're on that train too. Yep.
All right. Anything else on this section?
No, I'm ready to talk about family.
All right. So let's go on to number four, or part number four is feed your culture. And the very first section in this part of the book is titled We're Not Family, which I absolutely love this.
Yeah.
The whole idea that they present in this section of the book is that companies will use this phrase to manipulate the employees. This is a one-sided relationship from the perspective of we are family. And they define it as we are people who work together to make a product that we are proud of. We are not family. They say companies will use this to get loyalty even if they don't intend to pay it back. The best companies aren't families, but they are supporters of families like Basecamp is.
Yeah, I think of it as like you can choose your friends, but you can't choose your family. Well, if you choose the company, like again, you can't choose your family. So how does that work? Like how do, you know, it doesn't add up. I think it is important too to think it can go the other way as well. I don't think it's as common, but a lot of times it's the employer telling the employees, "We're all family." But and talking about how, you know, we're going to work on this together and trying to, you know, help each other. It can happen where the employer has a good view of that, but the employee expects it to operate as a family and then expects you to understand whenever they make a choice that the company wouldn't like. That does happen.
Mm-hmm.
And I only say that because I had to deal with it personally in the company that I was running. So I just wanted to point that out. There are cases where that coin can get flipped.
Yeah, and I think whenever you define it as family, there's going to be an unbalanced relationship here one way or the other. Either the employee is going to be taking advantage of the company, which I understand how that can happen too, working in a family business where there is a family dynamic and you can't fire people. And I understand how certain companies may feel that way. This person has been here forever and they put in an honest day's work. We can't let them go. Well, if you have been preaching the mantra that we're family, then you're right. You can't let them go. But the much more healthy approach is to say, even if you do work with family, you know, the family stuff is for family, the work stuff is at work, and you have to be able to disconnect those two and say, while we are at work, we are not family. but we are people who are working together to create something, to produce something, and hopefully, you know, we're proud of the thing that we're making. I think, you know, the more experience that I get working in different situations, the more thankful I am when you enter into a situation or an agreement and it's just, okay, we're going to base this on the quality of the work. It's almost like a breath of fresh air to me now. It's like, ah, yes. As long as I'm doing good work and I'm adding value to the company, I know that we're good.
Yeah.
And usually I can tell if what I'm doing isn't in alignment anymore, or, you know, we're starting to butt heads. We see things a little bit differently. They've got different goals, going back to that word. But it doesn't have to get to that point where feelings are hurt, but you basically guarantee it will as soon as you use this phrase that we're family.
Right. Something I've learned in working with a number of companies and in a handful of nonprofit and business ownership situations is that if you can find the right people who are good at what they do and willing to learn to do a good job, generally speaking, you can give them a task and not worry about it. This kind of goes back to what we were talking about earlier on about, you know, trying to micromanage and track everything. That's unnecessary if you have good people in place. I have a couple of volunteer teams that I oversee at the church, and over time we've built into a handful of people on each of those teams, and they're phenomenal. They do great work. I have no problem stepping away on a Sunday morning and letting them just run the Sunday without my help at all. And they do a great job with it. They don't need me there all the time. And that's something that I think a lot of companies could benefit from, is just getting out of their way, like letting your workers do their thing. And I think that's a lot of what they're getting at here in this section, Feed Your Culture, in that there are a lot of things that they do, like benefits wise and such, their expectations of time off and things. Like, those pieces are ones that they put in place to enable their people to live extremely healthy and balanced. Maybe not balance is a kind of a bad term for that, but a well-built lifestyle that allows the company to continue growing and building on what they want to do without draining the people who are doing the work. But again, a lot of that comes back to being willing to trust them and getting out of their way, enabling them and let them go. That's the moral of the story here.
Yeah. You know, you mentioned the benefits and the things that they have. It occurs to me that we're all family, that might be something that someone could say, and they could be sincere when they say it, and they mean it as a compliment, as a positive thing. But the response from every employee should be, show me the money. Give me the benefits instead.
Sure. Yeah.
Let me take a vacation and just disconnect. I really like how they don't negotiate the salaries at Basecamp, how they just pay the top 10% in whatever role based on San Francisco rates. They mentioned that they don't give bonuses because people tended to view the bonuses as part of the salary anyways. So they base those off of the standard salary and bonus totals in right. The top 10% in San Francisco, which is really, really cool. And they just say, this is what we're going to pay you. And maybe it costs the company a little bit more, but it breeds loyalty in the employees, I would argue. And they didn't really get into statistics behind like who comes and leaves. They did mention that there are a couple people who have moved on to other things after they've been at Basecamp. But they did mention that most people tend to stay for a while. And I think that this is a big reason for that. Like, maybe if they did the negotiations, they would be able to pay less, especially being in the Midwest, for people in specific roles. But they're just like, no, we're not going to say we're family. We're just going to show people that we care about them by paying them top dollar. I think that's pretty legit.
Yeah, For sure. Yeah, I think it's a bold move too.
Yep. Yeah, but it ultimately is not negatively impacting the business that they want to build. Is it maybe negatively impacting the maximum amount of profit that they could make? Yeah, but that's not their goal either, which we'll get to maybe towards the end of this book.
Yeah.
Let's jump into the next section here. Number five is dissect your process. And the big thing I wanted to talk about here is the idea of work chat, which is somewhat related to the presence prison, but I think there's a lot of value for a lot of different ways that people could work, not just at work, but in organizations, even families, where you can't always have instant feedback, instant communication. And the kind of ground rule they lay out here is real time, sometimes, asynchronous, most of the time. I think that's a great ground rule. They mentioned on page 133 that chat puts conversations on conveyor belts that are perpetually moving away from you. And if you're not at your station when the conversation rolls by, you'll never get a chance to put in your two cents. I've experienced this. And I even had a conversation with the family business. They were trying to make sure that they were all working on the same page at one point. And, you know, and they, well, one of the ways that we think we can do that is if we have these daily meetings. Do you want to be a part of them? I'm like, absolutely not.
Oh, come on.
You guys just do
why not,
what
Mike?
You wanted. Over the time that I have worked with the family business, that's been something that I've had to push back on and try gently, ever so carefully, to kind of move people towards this asynchronous communication. But I've seen the struggle that some people have with this, where they are just so used to working a certain way. And when they have an idea, it's got to get dealt with right now. And that's what chat allows remote workers to do. So for me, when I was taking a step back from the family business, it was kind of in response to this type of thing happening in the office all the time. And it just drove me nuts. It's like someone would walk in and be like, okay, we need to talk about this right now. I'm like, no, but I'm doing this thing right now. No, we got to forget what you're doing. Let's sit down and have an hour and a half long meeting, which was framed as just a few minutes, you know, and chat allows that to happen anywhere, anytime. And I have felt that pressure where it's like, well, we talked about it in the chat. Didn't you see it? And that kind of goes back to the presence prison. This is what feeds the presence prison, in my opinion, is this fact that these things, yes, you can view them whenever you want, but you are expected to view them. And if you let them go for a long time and they start to pile up and you have all these messages that you comb through, that feels like a lot. So the natural reaction, just like with emails, to check it all the time and to see what's new and to respond immediately so you don't forget about it and doesn't come back to bite you later when you give some feedback and they say, oh, well, it's too late because we've already done this other thing. And we talked about it. Didn't you see that? So I'm very much in favor of the way that chat happens in Basecamp, where you think things through and then you share the message and then people can respond whenever, but it's not something that you hammer out over work chat. If you really need to work through something, get a few people together on a phone call and talk it through.
I can tell you have a lot of opinions on communication. Like, of the subpoints from these sections you've selected there, like half of them involve communication in some form. Is this
true.
A bitter topic for you?
I wouldn't say it's a bitter topic. It's a very important topic. The men's curriculum that we go through at church, the guy who wrote it, Ed Cole, has a saying that says, communication is the basis of life. And I think that this is true for ministries. I think this is true for families. I think this is true for organizations. And if you never take the time to set the parameters for the communication, then you end up creating a big stress ball that people are forced to carry around all the time. It's like you're carrying around these in StoryBrand, they talk about don't give your potential customers too many 8-pound bowling balls to carry. That's kind of what it feels like when you don't explicitly say, you know, you don't have to chime in via work chat. And I totally see the where that evolves to if it's not checked. Like, you basically have to check it at some point. And most people will not ever stop to think about checking it. They're just going to continue with the process. They'll just go with the flow. And then you end up in this situation where you feel always connected and you just feel drained. So I think this is the thing that resonates with me for sure.
I think there's a lot of expectation that comes from doing things immediately. You hear the stories of startups and these tech companies that they started in a garage and they, you know, worked together all in the same room and they just pounded things out and they got it done. You have to know, like, they had tons of distractions. They just put in so much time working on it that they overcame that. And that kind of leads us to the point where we assume, like, if I need an answer right now, the best thing for me to do is to go find the person and get the answer, and then I can keep working on things, not even considering what that does for the other person. I feel that some of this comes from so much of our culture right now is built around, like, looking out for number one. And this definitely is that to the max, where I'm working on a project, so obviously you need to stop working on your videos to tell me the answer that I need.
Yeah.
Obviously, because what I'm doing is so important. Even if it's, you know, something mundane, like trying to put in the right number in an email, it's not that big a deal, but we assume and think it is. But because of that culture, it feeds this whole instant response. So many, you know, we can do a quick DuckDuckGo search because I don't want to say the other. Like, you can do these searches and get exactly what you want whenever you want. Well, that, you know, we should be able to get what we want when we want it, whenever we want it. Like, that's our expectation. But how many times have we read books and studied this stuff, Mike, where our gut reaction isn't always, or our instant answer isn't always the right solution because we didn't take the time to think through all the potentials? If we take the time to marinate on things, process it, and then kick out our response, we're going to have a better response in the long run. And I think that's what the whole culture behind Basecamp is dependent on. It's geared towards preventing those gut reactions, those instant responses, and enabling the slower thought out process. Like, that's what it's enabling. And it's not like it allows you to come up with better answers in the long run. I feel like so much of this comes back to that. But I think the work chat thing that you're talking about, like, that's instant feed me response to the max.
Yes. I think it was David Sparks who told me at one point that what meditation does for him is it creates space between the impulse and the response. And that's where the value lies. And I think that totally applies to a work situation too, especially when you are focused on the good of the product that you're going to make. You almost don't want the instant response. This is something that I've been talking through recently with different meetings and things at church and stuff that I'm trying to communicate effectively. Like, I want to have the space to respond appropriately after I look at the thing. And I don't want to just, like, show up and be surprised. And to be fair, like, everybody's totally on board with this once I explain it. But I don't want to just show up and then have something presented to me and then be asked to respond in the moment, because I know, and it's kind of galvanized after reading this book, that my response is probably not going to be the right one, or at least not 100% correct. And the real valuable thing that's going to allow us to move forward is if I create that space and I look at this thing through the right lens. And it's kind of shocking to me how rare that is in a lot of work situations specifically, because I see the value in taking your time and doing the thing the right way. And I think most people that you would ask that question, like given the option, do you want to just do it haphazardly right away or do you want to slow down and get it right? Almost everybody would say, let's slow down and get it right. Now, there's balance there. I mean, you do have to ship the thing eventually. So I'll mention that. But I think that most people think they would prefer to do it that way. But then when they get in the moment, it's like they completely forget about that. They're a completely different person.
Right.
It's like the lizard brain takes over and it's like, nah, forget that. I just want instant feedback.
Just give me the answer.
And it's just, yeah, yeah. And I don't understand it. Now, I'm sure people could point to stuff that I do too, that where I fall into that. But I see it and I'm like, what is wrong with you people? Don't you know? I feel like I'm taking crazy pills. But
yeah, I had this conversation with my wife, was it last night? Two nights ago, that, you know, I notice things on Sunday morning that are technical anomalies or difficulties that are wrong. Like I notice when things are wrong. I know when the slide is a half second too slow coming on the screen. I know when there's a slight buzz in a line and they got the pad on it instead of setting the gain correctly. I notice when the compressor's set wrong. I notice when the cabling's not right on stage. Like I notice all these things. And it doesn't matter if it's the church that I work at or if it's someplace I'm visiting, an event center. Doesn't matter. I've been to big conferences and just noticed all the things wrong with the sound system. Like, I noticed these things.
You noticed them at my church and we put you to work fixing them.
It's true. It's true. We went to Mike's churches. Like, I ended up in the booth all night and I loved it. It was great. And, like, I noticed these things. And when you become aware of them, you notice how frequent they happen. It's the same concept behind, like, if you buy a white Toyota Prius, you start to notice white Priuses everywhere. It's that concept. Once you become aware of one, you start to notice it in a lot of different areas. I think this is the same thing, Mike, in that you have a tendency to notice when, like, you become aware of the scenario when communication systems aren't working well. I feel like you notice those. So then you see all the ways that they operate wrong, but not everyone has that awareness. So they don't even understand that that is something to be changed. And my point to that my wife and I were working through was that when you have that awareness, you also develop the responsibility to either act on it or help the people who aren't aware of it.
Sure.
So in my case, like, yes, I notice all the technical things that go wrong. Well, that's an opportunity for me to talk to the people who are running it and say, hey, did you notice X, Y, and Z? Most of the time, the answer is no, I didn't even know that was a thing. And then the next time they notice it, and now they are infected and cannot stop the mental difficulties with noticing these things as well, because they become aware of it. So then, you know, overall, people are able to grow and get better in the long run. But I think what you're talking about is you're just aware of it and you can't, I don't want to say you can't see it, but you're not in a position always to be able to convey like how it should be changed. Like that's not a position that you fill in a lot of these scenarios. I think. I'm kind of making an assumption there.
No, I think you're right. You know, sometimes another aspect of this, by the way, is that Chris Bailey, I think, was the one who originally said that people are more important than productivity. So, and there again is maybe an improper use of the word productivity if I want to define it the way that I defined it, but really people are the principal thing. So the relationship maybe is worth more than the effective communication. Maybe if it's going to damage the relationship, you should just shut up and let it be. That's what I have to wrestle against.
Sure, sure.
So sometimes it's just framing it the right way. Sometimes it is communicating it effectively myself. Sometimes it is knowing that this battle just isn't worth fighting. And I think that's probably true for a lot of people, no matter what position you find yourself in. You could be the CEO of a Fortune 500 company, and it doesn't mean that you can always get your way and terms of setting the rules of engagement when it comes to communication. So I think it's very fluid, and it's something that you have to figure out, not just for yourself, but for every aspect of your life. Fair but not equal sort of a thing.
Yeah, absolutely.
All right. Part six is mind your business, and lots of cool stuff in here. I'm trying to keep it short because we're running long. So the thing maybe worth talking about is the don't worry about copycats. And I picked this just because this resonates with me. My dad started the family business before I was even born and was running it out of his house for a while, and then eventually grew it to the point where he had an office. But I remember at one point that I think I was maybe in high school when this happened, there was a big name counselor in, I probably shouldn't even say the field, but if I mentioned the name, you would probably recognize it, that was taking an assessment that my dad had developed. And at that point, it was software, and also there was a PDF version, like a print manual that would go with it. This was back in the days of CDs. So they bought one CD and a PDF manual, and then basically took the assessment from the software, which the license obviously is like, you can use this on your one computer with a few people. And they took it and they used it with lots and lots and lots and lots of people. In fact, they had a whole system where they had service providers who had to get certified by them, and they were using this tool that my dad had created. So total copyright infringement. And at that point, as a small software company, my dad basically felt like, well, I've got to sue this guy. And I remember this lawsuit dragging out for years. And in the end, even though my dad had all of the rights and had everything, had all of the power in the situation, eventually, you know, the guy who was copywriting, he grew old and just kind of left the business. And the last thing I remember was that we were going to win the lawsuit, but he was declaring bankruptcy. Big national name. And I remember thinking at that point, like, this wasn't worth it, because I saw how much it ate at my dad. And that's instantly what came to mind when I read this section in this book, because they basically say, people copy our stuff all the time. Sometimes they just rip stuff off and they put it into a lousy product. And at that point, you're really angry, because not only did they copy your thing, but they did it bad.
Right.
They did it poorly. Right. And he's just like, doesn't matter. It's not worth it. It's not worth investing the emotional energy into fighting for this thing. And I think there's a lot of truth to that. Again, seeing how much it impacted my dad, how angry he would get whenever he would just think about this. There's nothing he can do. Can't get the guy on the phone to talk about it rationally or anything. It's affecting everything that he's trying to do, as he's at the same time trying to maintain a normal day-to-day existence and grow his company while fighting this guy who has a bunch more people and a bunch more money to throw at defending this thing. And it's kind of like a losing battle. Even if you win the lawsuit, you know, you're not going to get anything from it. All you're going to do is you're going to invest a whole bunch of time and a whole bunch of emotional energy into this thing, and kind of there's no good that's going to come from this. So I kind of resolved after I saw that. And then again, when I read this, like, don't worry about that stuff, because it's always going to be there. There's always going to be somebody who's trying to copy you if you do anything worthwhile. And maybe this is naive of me to say, but kind of my approach ever since then, not that I've been in that same situation, has been like, go ahead and let them try to keep up. If they copy something, that's fine, because we'll be on to the next thing. I think that's a much healthier approach to this.
But it's a very hard one to adopt.
Totally.
By a long shot. I can't say that I've had anyone rip off like what I've done online. I have had people take my ideas and then not give me credit for them. That really bothers me, and it drives me nuts, and I've had it happen way more than I care to admit. But what do you do about it? You know, it's not worth
exactly
throwing a fit. You know, in most cases, what happens is, yes, they've ripped off the idea, but they don't understand it well enough to execute it right. So it ends up falling apart anyway.
Yep.
Whereas if I were to take that same idea and do it myself, it would have a much better chance of success than if they had done it or when they did it, just because I have the full experience and knowledge behind where it came from. So yes,
exactly.
Just ignore the copycats. They're just, it's not worth it.
It's so hard to do. You know, I get it, but the whole game around, I made this thing, now it's copyrighted. So what? So you can defend your copyright? Nah, that just doesn't seem worth it to me.
Right, right.
And again, I know that there's probably people somewhere where they have a very legitimate reason to do that sort of thing, and they would argue very validly against my naive statement of this problem. I get that, you know, it's not going to apply to everybody everywhere, but I think in my situation, generally speaking, just water under the bridge. Just let it go. Hanging on to it is not going to have any sort of long-term positive effect.
Right. What's last, Mike?
Last is last.
Yes, I got it right.
The main idea with this last section is basically a call to consider everything that you've read up until this point. They say here that a business is a collection of choices. And I think what that does is it makes you think about all of the individual chapters, which again, you know, maybe there were individual blog posts at one point, as each one of those as a choice that you could make in terms of setting the direction for your company. But also, if you can't change your company, which they call out here at the end and why I wanted to mention it at the very beginning, you always have the ability to change yourself. So don't get frustrated that your sphere of influence isn't as big as you want it to be. Just recognize what you can control and do the best with what you've got.
Yeah, they have a phrase at the end of this, you know, choose a calm company, like choose to be calm instead of reacting and moving quickly and needing answers. Now, slow down, make deliberate decisions, and act on them. Like that's the sum total of the way Basecamp works. And I would say that's the overarching premise of the book. It's just, you know, choose to be calm. That's the resounding statement here.
Yep. Don't be creepy. Don't be crazy. Don't be a jerk.
Now, here's the hard question, Mike. Are you ready?
Yep.
What action items do you have from this? Because there could be a ton here. I know in the outline we have nothing at the moment, but there could be so many here.
Yeah, I thought about that as I was reading this. And with each chapter that went by, and I'm like, I don't have an action item yet. I got a little bit more nervous.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't know that I have any action items.
Oh, you can't do
that, Mike.
Then
I will say this one, because this is the one that really kind of got me thinking, like, how do I apply this? But it's not something that we can mark off as complete. Not that that's ever stopped me before.
This is what we do all the time.
Yeah. They talk about the two different tokens in the Mind Your Business section. And they say there is a no big deal token and there is a the end of the world token. And when it comes to support for your customers, whichever one you pick, the customer will choose the opposite. So the question is, which one are you leaving for your customer? Now, I don't do a whole lot of support. I do here and there. I don't necessarily think that this is going to be applied for me in a support scenario, although that's what they're talking about, and it definitely could be. But I also think that maybe there's value in taking this approach with your family or your kids, where if your kids come up and they're something's a really big deal to them, you know, you can adjust their perspective, but it's not going to be as simple as like, oh, knock it off. It's not that big a deal. That doesn't work. Trust me, I tried. Yeah. So when they come to you with a problem, you know, could this approach work in that scenario? I think probably there's nuance and sometimes it will, sometimes it won't, but it's got me thinking about how I respond to things. Again, I have no idea what sort of fruit is going to come from considering this as an action item, but if you're going to make me pick one, that would be
all
it.
Right.
Consider which token I'm picking and which one I'm leaving for other people.
Sure. I think I've got maybe two action items here. One is I'm reading, they have an online book called Shape Up, which is like the technicals of how the company operates, not just the high level philosophical side like this. I want to finish reading that because I started reading it about the time I finished this one. So it's not really a book. It's all web pages. But so I want to finish going through that as part one. And part two, I think I want to formally put together 6-week cycles with what I'm doing at the church. I think I'm going to have a conversation with my boss either Sunday or Monday morning and see if I can get that in motion. So I want to try it. I just want to see how that would work out.
Nice.
That's what I got.
We will definitely have to follow up on that one.
We'll see.
All right. So style and rating. I like this book a lot. I think that there's something here for everybody. I don't necessarily like some of the language.
I was going to ask. Yeah, because there's a decent amount of language in this.
Yeah, they totally use it for shock value at specific points, but you're talking about work, guys. Just chill out.
But if you follow them online, that's just who they are. Like, that's the way that they
yes,
write.
Yes, exactly. So it's not manufactured. I'm sure it is authentic, but also as I was reading it, I'm like, dude, just settle down. I also think it's very possible, like me this time, when you go through it and there's not necessarily any action items from this, a lot of stuff that maybe is inspiring or you're like, oh, I wish that I could apply that. And maybe there's limited influence that you have in terms of implementing this stuff. But I do think that it's a very worthwhile book. I'm very glad that it exists. If for no other reason to push back against the typical corporate culture, because Basecamp has had enough success to get attention, and by taking a strong stance and saying, you don't have to do this, that, and the other thing, it has more credibility than when I say it. I think that their company is fascinating. We didn't even get into the section about your big customers and how the worst customer is the one that you can't afford to lose, and why they charge every single company that uses Basecamp the same amount of money. It's totally against everything that people would advise you if you were trying to maximize your revenue. And they're just kind of like, we don't care. We just want to make a cool company and a cool product, which maybe is easier if you're partnering with the guy who invented Ruby. I don't know.
Maybe, yeah.
Maybe that's not right. Maybe Ruby he's not the inventor, but I know he's big in the Ruby space. Yeah. That's how I first became aware of it. So
yeah, he's the David Heinemeier Hansen is the developer behind Ruby on Rails. So I don't think he's the developer Ruby. It's the Rails side of it.
Gotcha. Okay. Thank you for clarifying. But yeah, I mean, when you have somebody like that who's building your product, that is probably an advantage.
Yes, only slightly, you know, slight edge.
So ever since I've been aware of Basecamp, that's kind of been in the back of my mind. It's like, well, if he's not there, how successful is this thing really? Which maybe is completely unfair. I don't know. I'm kind of talking around this topic of Basecamp in general. Not just the book specifically, but I think that influences my perspective as I read this book too. And so it's hard for me to, and maybe I shouldn't, you know, try to disconnect those two. I think Basecamp is a great product. I'm really happy with using it with Blanc Media. It's very different than a lot of the other stuff that I've used. It's definitely not going to be for everybody. You have to have the right perspective in order to use it, which from that, when you recognize that, you kind of totally understand why this book exists, because it is a sales pitch for Basecamp pretty much. All that being said, I still think there's a lot of valuable stuff in here. It's definitely an easy read. It's not something that I would consider super meaty. It's not going to, I think, anyways, change your world. But there's a lot of great stuff in here. I'm going to rate it at 4.0.
Nice. So I think I'm going to join you at 4.0. And I say that because you're absolutely correct. It's an easy book to read. It's one I would recommend. And it's one that I obviously have read it again and plan to read it again, which is a little bit weird because it's in, like, a lot of times people say, well, why don't you reread your 5.0s? Like, that would make perfect sense. Like, it doesn't always, like, choosing a book to reread doesn't necessarily revolve around the rating on it, because I feel like the long-term impact is sometimes different because those ratings are like gut, like immediately when they happen. Maybe that's an argument to not do that. We need to go back and re-rate everything, Mike. We have like an immediate rating and a long-term rating.
Maybe we'll do that for episode 100.
There you go. We're going to re-rate every book we've gone through. That'll be like a 3-hour episode. So the thing that I find is that, yes, this is an excellent book to go through. I got a lot out of it and will probably do so again in the future. But I can't say it's like groundbreaking. And there's, you know, pictures on every other page with it, it seems like, and a lot of blank spaces. So, yes, it's, you know, a decent sized book. Though mine, I should say this, mine is flawed because I have pages that are duplicated. There's like a whole bank of 40 pages that's in my book twice. It's really weird in the printing on it. So I probably shouldn't rate it super high because the printing on it was wrong. I don't know how that happened. But I do have a 40 page bank in my book that's repeated. It's weird. Yeah, strange. I haven't run into that ever before. I've run into situations where like the words are slightly out of alignment because the line didn't get printed evenly, so words are broken up a little bit. I have run into that before, but that's the first time I've ever had like the like entire pages duplicated in there. It's strange. I'll show it to you sometime. But I'm going to join you at the 4.0. I think that's a good place to put this. But again, I enjoy the book and love the company Basecamp. I feel like I'm trying to learn from them all the time.
Nice. All right, so what's next?
So the next one up is Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance. I know you're really excited about this, Mike. This is definitely one I know you're going to absolutely love.
All right. Why do you do this to me, Joe?
I don't know. It's fun. I enjoy this. It's not Amanda Palmer.
A little too much, I think.
You can't be too upset.
Yeah. Last episode, we talked a little bit about an idea, which I know appears in Good to Great by Jim Collins. And I feel like this is something we need in the bookworm library.
Sure.
So I'm going to make you read it with me.
Okay. I have two of these. We were talking about this before we started recording. I have two of these books. I paid $1 for one and the other one was given to me. So if you want one, but I think you already have it.
I think I also have two copies, actually.
So hopefully we really like it and I can give them to somebody. Do you have any Gap books?
I do. And this one was actually recommended recently. So if this ends up being a great book, we may turn this into an actual episode. But I have the book Tiny Habits by BJ Fogg, which I saw in the airport not too long ago. But BJ Fogg, the name sounded vaguely familiar. And I recognized after I looked into it that actually BJ Fogg is credited with a bunch of stuff from Atomic Habits.
Oh, sure.
So I'm interested to dig into this one. Fascinated by the topic of habits. Atomic Habits is currently my clear recommendation for people whenever they have a question about habits. But I've heard a lot of great things about this book as well.
Sure. I don't have a gap book this time, but that's kind of the norm lately. Apologies. I'll get there soon. I can see the light at the end of the tunnel. We're coming. I hope it's not a train. That just occurred to me. I hope it's not a train.
All right. Well, if you want to support the show, you can become a Bookworm Club premium member. You can go to bookworm.fm/membership. And for $5 a month, or I think $50 a year, haven't checked that recently, but
yes,
there is a yearly option thanks to Joe's technical wizardry. You can support the show and you can get access to a bunch of bonus stuff like the mind maps that I create as I take notes on all of these books. A lot of my gap books are up there as well. So those are all in the premium area of the club. And there's a Bookworm wallpaper that you can download and put on your computer that Joe's got some gap book episodes that he's created. So a bunch of additional bonuses, but ultimately, oh, and you can listen to the recordings live. So, but for everybody who is currently a paying member, we really appreciate your support. And if you want to support the show, you can check that out at bookworm.fm/membership.
Awesome. Well, if you're interested in how much Mike dislikes story-based books, you should check in on our next episode, Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance. And we'll check in on that one next time. Thanks for listening.